The Golden Age of Radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the Golden Age of Radio, Bernadine Flynn offers the news from 1944 on Crisco's radio newspaper. Hollywood is on the air with a movie preview of the 1938 film Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and the adventures of Horatio Hornblower starring Michael Redgrave from 1953. Stay tuned for the Golden Age of Radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, Hollywood is on the air with a movie preview of the 1938 film Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Also, the adventures of Horatio Hornblower starring Michael Redgrave from 1953. Right now, Bernadine Flynn and Durward Kirby offer the news from 1944 on Crisco's radio newspaper as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Crisco's radio newspaper with Bernadine Flynn. Brought to you by Crisco, the pure all-vegetable shortening. It's digestible. Now, Bernadine Flynn.
Thank you, Durward, and hello, friends. Before Durward Kirby brings us the latest world news, I want to tell you a little story about Sergeant Louis Newbar, who is stationed at Fort Douglas, Utah. Sergeant Newbar, it seems, just doesn't like to be crowded. So, for a long time, he's made it a practice to get up a little earlier than the rest of the soldiers in the barracks so he can shave ahead of the washroom rush. The other morning, he was awakened by noises coming from the squad room. Time to get up, he said to himself, and drowsily threw the covers back and hustled down to shave. He carefully finished the job and then returned to the barracks, for some reason or other not feeling as though he'd had enough sleep. And when he re-entered the barracks, the truth dawned on him. No wonder he felt as though he hadn't slept enough. It was only 1 o'clock in the morning. The noise he'd heard was some of the boys just coming in. And now, Durward, what's the latest world news?
American heavy bombers picked up the air offensive against Western Europe this morning, Byrne. Our flying fortresses blasted targets at Brunswick, one of Germany's major manufacturers of aircraft engines, as well as an important communications center. The fortresses were escorted into their target by formations of American and British fighters. Early reports say there was heavy anti-aircraft fire, but practically no German fighter plane opposition. Our Liberators and other planes also bombed the French invasion coast. In London, Britain's Air Minister, Sir Archibald Sinclair, says that air supremacy over Germany to blast open the road to Berlin now lies within the grasp of the Allies. He says that our historic aerial offensive is producing visible, measurable, and progressive results. However, Sinclair cautions that Germany is still capable of striking back in heavy force. General Arnold, the United States Army's air chief, has commended the 15th Air Force in Italy for last week's raids on German aircraft plants. He says that those attacks laid the foundations for final and decisive operations in the future. In Italy, the heaviest artillery duels in 10 days have broken the lull on the Anzio beachhead. British troops have broken up a series of small German attacks, and other Allied troops have mopped up a number of Germans who wriggled through the lines near Cassino. From Russia, Premier Joseph Stalin has sent a message to President Roosevelt, predicting that the time is near when the Allies will defeat Hitlerite Germany. On the Russian battlefronts today, the Red Army is racing over the approaches to Pskov and nearing the outskirts of the town itself. In Moscow, a special Russian atrocity commission has made a full report on the brutality of German occupation forces at Kiev. The commission is holding Field Marshal von Manstein, the German commander in southern Russia, responsible for 195,000 murders in the Kiev area. Finland's parliament held a secret session this morning, presumably to discuss chances for an acceptable separate peace with Russia, And there is also a report that Sweden will do its best to provide Finland with food if the Finns get out of the war. On the other side of the world, there is good news in our war against the Japs. First of all, the Navy Department reveals that our submarines have sunk 14 more Japanese merchant vessels. And in New Delhi, Admiral Mountbatten has issued an order of the day to his forces in Burma, saying that their complete victory on the Arakan front has given the Japanese a crack they will remember. In the Southwest Pacific, American air and naval forces have delivered another heavy blow to Japanese shipping, destroying or damaging 29 Japanese planes, 34 barges, and 2 cargo ships. And the Japs admit that they lack sufficient aircraft to cope with the growing Allied offensive actions. In this hemisphere, in Buenos Aires, the police say that they seized documents of the German Trans-Ocean News Agency to prove that it was connected with spy rings in countries bordering Argentina. Also, the Tokyo Radio, by the way, has come forth with one of the best of the war's wisecracks. Unconscious variety, that is. After telling of new American successes, the Jap announcer asked, "What shall we do now?" And then solemnly answered his own question by saying, "Now is the time that the people of Japan should stand up with resolute determination, glaring at the enemy." Well, some Marine probably has the answer to that one with, "Glare ahead, brother, we're coming in anyway." And that's the top of today's world news. Now, Bernardine, I believe you have something of interest for our listeners.
The other day I was talking to a woman who runs a cooking school, and we got to comparing notes, particularly about Crisco. She said she'd just never seen so many dyed-in-the-wool butter users who are being won over to Crisco for cakes.
Well, that wasn't any surprise to you, was it, Fern?
No, but I'm glad I'm not the only one who's noticing it. Really, friends, don't you think butter for cakes got to be kind of a habit? Why, with Crisco, you can make some of the best-tasting cakes you ever put in your mouth. Full of flavor, wonderful texture, and light as a feather. Like the maple walnut cake I made yesterday. You just add chopped walnuts to a regular yellow layer cake batter. And for the frosting, use a boiled icing with maple syrup in it. Anyway, the cake was delicious. As good as any butter cake ever thought of being.
And what about that lighter cake secret of Crisco's, Vern?
Oh, yes. Why, friends, do you know that with Crisco, you can make a lighter cake than with any other shortening, even the most expensive? It's amazing to think a shortening can make that much difference. But you just try a Crisco cake and see. See if you ever tasted a cake quite as light or one that was quite as good.
Now, Bernardine, how about another story?
This is a story about the Red Cross, Durward. Not long ago, Red Cross relief representatives were standing on a dock under a hot African sun and watching a large gray refugee ship move in through the harbor. There were children on board, 300 or 400 young refugees from Greece. There were adults on the ship, too, many of them ill, others forlorn and bewildered. They had seen their country ruthlessly devastated by the Germans. For most of them, everything they'd ever owned had been lost. They had only the baggage they carried. One very old lady refused the assistance of a young native boy who ran out to help her. She was afraid to let her few pitiful belongings out of her sight. Then there was a little girl, blonde and blue-eyed and not more than 6 years old. She had no baggage at all. All she owned was on her back, a shapeless dress made from an old burlap sack. As the refugees streamed onto the dock, Red Cross workers passed among them, distributing refreshments and clothing and making assignments for temporary homes. The little girl in the burlap was given a new Red Cross dress. She didn't know what to say. She hugged it to her and stared at the Red Cross worker with unbelieving eyes. It had been so long since she'd had anything pretty or clean or new. The next day, though, the Red Cross workers were surprised to see the little girl still wearing her ragged gunny sack dress. "Where's your new dress, dear?" the Red Cross lady asked her. "Did you lose it?" The child was silent for a moment, and she looked up timidly and said, "Please, my mother had to stay behind in Greece. Someday I'm going back and find her, and please, I want to save my Red Cross dress for her." Heartwarming, sincere little stories like this are told every day by the thousands of Red Cross workers all over the world. The Red Cross is on the job, lending a helping hand on the battlefields, in the liberated countries, and on the home front. They help the needy regardless of race or color or nationality. Tomorrow, friends, the Red Cross begins its annual membership drive. The goal is set high this year, for there is much work to be done. That means we must back the Red Cross more than ever. You and I, and the people who live up the street, and those around the corner, and on the other side of town. Each one of us must do all we can to see that this great organization is kept going at full strength. When one of the volunteer workers calls on us, let's give and give again, for the Red Cross needs our help.
You're very right, Byrne. Our contributions couldn't go for a better cause.
By the way, Durwood, how was your trip to New York last week?
Oh, it was swell, Byrne, just swell. It was a bond-selling trip, you know, and we really sold the bonds, approximately $10 million worth in all.
Wonderful.
And it was the first time I'd been to New York in 10 years.
Oh?
And believe me, it sure has changed. The thing that struck me most was the number of different uniforms you see on the sidewalks of New York. I saw fighting men and women from every one of the United Nations and from every branch of their armed forces. It was really a wonderful sight. And it sort of set my spine to tingling to know that all those people, New Zealanders, Canadians, British, French, Dutch, Russians, and all the others are fighting shoulder to shoulder with us to help make the world a happier place in which to live. And just to look at their faces, you just know we can't lose.
Oh, it must have been thrilling, Derry.
It surely was. You know, I also got a big kick out of going up to the top of the Empire State Building. A stranger in town, you know.
Yeah.
We were 1,028 feet above the street, 102 stories, and the wind that day was blowing 55 miles an hour at that height.
Ooh.
And listen, when you get to New York again, Byrne,
mm-hmm.
you don't want to miss a ride on the Staten Island Ferry. It's a half-hour trip for just a nickel.
Wow.
And the subways, you can ride all over the city for 5 cents. You really get your money's worth in transportation out of a nickel in New York.
Well, how are traveling conditions, Derwin?
Pretty crowded. You know, I couldn't get a plane reservation Sunday night, and I was lucky, very lucky, to get train tickets. I tell you, the government means it when it says very sincerely, please don't travel unless you have to, because everything is jam-packed.
And now, Durward, what's the latest on the home front?
Well, the OPA announced just about 2 hours ago that the point values of pork and many beef cuts will be sharply reduced starting Sunday. The pork reductions will range from 1 to 3 points, and only spare ribs will remain unchanged. The beef cuts used for roasts, rib steaks, and stews also will be reduced 1 to 2 points. The OPA says, on the average, we will get 8% more meat next month. However, point values for veal, lamb, mutton, butter, cheese, lard, and other dairy products will be unchanged in March.
Durward, what's the latest on the draft today?
Reports from nearly every state in the Union show that draft quotas are not being met.
What's the answer to that, Durward?
There are various opinions. Senator Johnson and Senator Wheeler disagree with President Roosevelt's medical commission and think the armed forces should lower their physical standards to take more 4Fs. And others point out that about the only substantial manpower pool left, that is outside of the fathers, is the group of 2 million single men with occupational deferments. And of course, you know that President Roosevelt has ordered all occupational deferments reviewed.
Elsewhere on the home front, the Commerce Department says that one out of every three American families now has an income of more than $3,000 a year. That compares with only 1 in 10 families between 1935 and 1940.
And another survey shows that it takes at least $13.23 a week to buy food for a family of 5 in New York City. And that's $2.16 more than last year. Say, Byrne, someone asked me why ration tokens are needed. Can you explain that?
Oh, easily. You see, red stamps and blue stamps in Ration Book 4 will each be worth 10 points. Instead of getting your change in stamps, you now get tokens, which are good indefinitely. Do you ever experiment when you're cooking? You know, make up recipes? Well, last week I had some bologna, and I thought, well, now that would be grand for dinner if I can just think of some new way of cooking it.
I think I smell a recipe coming along.
Well, I did put together a dish I thought was good. It's very simple. Bologna and noodle put together, I called it. Maybe you'd like to try it. You just fry cubes of bologna, chopped onion, and some sliced mushrooms in piping hot Crisco. When the bologna and onion have a nice crisp brown look, Mix in the cooked noodles and heat thoroughly. Then serve. I think your family will like it. Mine cleaned up every last speck.
And, ladies, don't forget that with Crisco in your frying pan, you don't have to worry about upset digestions either.
I should say not. Why, Crisco fried foods are so digestible, even the youngsters can enjoy them.
You see, Crisco is pure and all vegetable. Digestible itself. And it's the finest quality shortening you can use. Now, remember, with Crisco, everything you cook tastes better. And it's digestible.
And now, Durward, what's our last story?
It seems that Navy chaplains never forget themselves, even though they do travel in an atmosphere of, shall I say, purple vocabularies. Take, for instance, Chaplain Lonnie Meacham of Virginia Beach. The story goes he was standing in the chow line when someone accidentally spilled hot soup on him. The dignified chaplain didn't say a word for a moment, and then he slowly turned around to the men behind him, and he said, "Would some of you fellows say a few appropriate words, please?" Well, friends, that's all for now. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of Crisco's Radio Newspaper.
Durward Kirby will bring you the latest world news.
Bernardine Flynn will give you the colorful human interest side of the news.
And we're both saying goodbye for Crisco.
Been talking about it for months. Critics pronounce it another milestone in the advancement of motion picture entertainment. 3 years in the making. 600 artists contributed 2 million drawings. Sound technicians recorded for 2 years. Cameramen developed a special third-dimension multiplane camera. Its Hollywood premiere attracted every important executive and star. You've read about it in your favorite magazines and newspapers. You've heard about it from coast to coast. The picture, of course, Walt Disney's supreme achievement, his first full-length feature, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. RKO Radio Pictures is proud to present a special radio preview of the most delightful picture of 1938, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, adapted from Grimm's fairy tales by that master of movie entertainment, the creator of Mickey Mouse, Minnie Mouse, Donald Duck, and scores of screen entertainers, Walt Disney. In the Walt Disney version of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the story opens in a beautiful medieval castle, home of the Princess Snow White. Inside, we see Snow White's stepmother, the Wicked Queen, standing in front of her magic mirror. Having been told by the magic mirror that Snow White is more beautiful than she is, the Queen decides to have Snow White killed. But the little princess knows nothing of the Queen's hate. Out in the courtyard, she is drawing water from a well. Her friends, the birds, flutter around her as she sings the Wishing Well song. In her song, the echo from the well accompanies her.
I'm wishing for the one I love to find me today. I'm hoping, and I'm dreaming of the nice things you say.
The singer who interrupts Snow White at the end of the song is her Prince Charming. Now it's his turn to sing as he expresses his love to the beautiful princess in the hit tune, One Song.
One song, I have but one song. One song, only for you. One heart, tenderly beating, ever entreating, constant and true. One love that has possessed me. One love really through. One song my heart keeps singing.
wicked queen orders one of her huntsmen to take Snow White into the forest and kill her. But he cannot bear to hurt the little princess, so he orders her to run away into the woods. Terrified, she dashes through the dark forest until she falls exhausted. Then the little animals in the forest find Snow White. The squirrels, rabbits, deer, even the bluebirds gather around as she greets the animals with a smile and a song.
With a smile and a song. Life is just like a bright sunny day. Your cares fade away. And your heart is young. With a smile and a song. All the world.
Lead Snow White to a place of safety, the cottage of the seven dwarfs. The cottage is very untidy, so Snow White and the animals clean the house to the rhythm of another hit tune, Whistle While You Work.
Just whistle while you work, and cheerfully together we can tidy up the place, so I'm a merry tune. It won't take long when there's a song to help you set the pace. And as you sweep the room, imagine that the room is someone that you love, and soon you'll find you dancing for the tune.
Oh, no, 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 no. Put them in the tub.
When hearts are high, the time will find the whistle while you work.
The dwarfs are working in their diamond mine. The 5 o'clock whistle blows, and they stop work. Starting for home, the dwarfs strike up their marching song. Hi-ho.
Hi-ho. Hi-ho, 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 it's home from work we go.
Arriving home, the dwarfs are astonished to find Snow White asleep in their beds. Grumpy, the woman-hater, wants to turn her out into the forest. But the others insist she stay, especially when they learn she can cook gooseberry pies. Before eating dinner, however, Snow White makes the dwarfs wash their hands and faces, which have not been cleaned for 2 weeks. How they hate it as they chant the washing song.
Step up to the tub. Hey, no disgrace. Just pull up your sleeves and get up in place. Then scoop up the water and rub it on your face and go... Pick up the soap. Now don't try to bluff. Work up the leather. And when you've got enough, get your hands full of water. Snort and you snuff and go... You Douse and dump. Rub and scrub. Sputter and splash all over the tub. You may be cold and wet when you're done, but you gotta admit it's good sweet fun. So splash all you like. Ain't any trick. As soon as you're through, you'll feel mighty slick.
Don't you old nanny, don't you make me sick going.
That he looks kind of cute, as cool as he's dry.
Let him good, let him go, let him good, let him hide, you know.
After dinner, the dwarfs have a party. Snow White tells them about her prince as she sings, "Someday my prince will come." Many thrilling adventures, Snow White's Prince Charming does come. He carries her away to his castle, and they live happily ever after. We have just presented a special musical radio preview of Walt Disney's first full-length animated feature, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, filmed entirely in Technicolor. 3 years in the making, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs is released by RKO Radio Pictures.
Like to present to you a man of great renown and fame, an illustrious poet, Falstaff by name.
Yuck, 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 yuck.
Thank you, thank you. I have a message to speak for those who entertainment seek. If you want to hear Dinah sing at her best, I recommend with enthusiasm and zest that Samuel Goldwyn's new picture you see. Up in Arms, it's called. And take it from me, with a great new star named Danny Kaye. It's marvelous, musical, mirthful, and gay. You'll laugh, you'll chuckle, you'll scream, you'll holler when you see Up in Arms in Technicolor.
You're listening to the Golden Age of Radio with a movie preview of the 1938 film Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. We also heard Crisco's radio newspaper with Bernadine Flynn and Durwood Kirby, first broadcast on February 29, 1944. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s, when the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Right now, The Adventures of Horatio Hornblower, starring Michael Redgrave from 1953. As WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Call all hands, beat to quarters. Run out the guns, stand by this starboard battery.
One broadside into it, if you please, Captain Bush.
Pointers on target. Linstocks ready.
Aye, aye, sir. Ready.
Fire!
Presenting Michael Redgrave as C.S. Forrester's indomitable man of the sea, Horatio Hornblower.
Invalided home in time for Christmas. Feeling a trifle seedy still, of course, for somehow, in following a French retreat from Riga, I picked up one of those illnesses which scourge armies on land. I had quite a bout of it, in fact. And then my old friend Captain Bush had brought me home aboard the Nonsuch. Home to Smallbridge, where the days passed quietly, serenely. Oh, wonderful days. But I began to want to see old Bush again. So not long after New Year's Day, we coaxed him down from London for a winter weekend with us. It was old times again. Well, now, some port, what you say.
Oh,
Wiggins has left it, I'm glad to see. You know, One night up in the Gulf of Riga, you seemed amused by a yarn of mine from my midshipman days, Bush. I never told you, did I, about my first independent command and what it led to in the way of, self-knowledge.
No?
You know, extremely young men are rather sad to contemplate, aren't they, as one grows older? That terrible resolve that everything must turn out right. Their monstrous earnestness. I hadn't been so long aboard the Indefatigable under Captain Pellew. I'd just come there as a Gorky midshipman, you know, from the Justinian. And to have reached a frigate of the line had me quite dazzled just then. We were on patrol in the Bay of Biscay, and we'd fallen on a convoy of French merchant ships most opportunely. The French men of war, which should have been escorting them to Brest, were otherwise engaged that day, for our own fleet had attacked them miles further out in the Atlantic. And as the unescorted merchantmen fled towards home, filled with the food revolutionary France needed so desperately, Captain Pellew set out to capture as many as he could, snatching the prizes one by one.
That French is too slow to surrender, Lieutenant Mason. Give her a shot across her bows from the 9 pounders.
Aye, aye, sir.
Not into our hull, confound it, Mason. I didn't mean that man. Only meant cripple her.
Aye, aye, sir. That last one was dangerously near her waterline. Gunlayers, change point of aim. Fire into our rigging. Ready? Fire! Another one, sir? No, wait. Isn't that flag coming down? Why, yes, I do believe it is, sir.
High time it did. That last shot had good elevation. Ruined the slings of that fore topsail yard. Even the sail is down. All right. Let's heave to, close beside her. Have a broadside ready, Mason, in case she tries some trick. Give him a speaking trumpet. Ahoy there! What brig are you?
Marie Galante of Bordeaux, 24 days out of New Orleans, in America, with rice.
Rice? That'll sell for a pretty penny, sir, when we get her home to England. 200 tons, I should imagine, and 12 in her crew at most.
Yes. He'll need a prize crew of, I'd say 4, eh? It's a midshipman's command. Now, let me see. Mr. Hornblower!
Yeah, wait. Don't want to go all the way overside, do you? Or are you trying to knock us all breathless, huh?
I'm so sorry.
Never mind. I'm only joking. You're a featherweight. Why, it's young Hornblower. I thought the old man was sending down an officer.
I suppose I was all that was left. Elsie, easiest to spare at this point, Mr. Walser.
Pull for the French brig, man.
All right, sir.
Think you can manage all right, Mr. Hornblower?
Yes, sir.
That French crew's likely to be nasty.
I feel sure, sir, that I can.
Yes. Your first command, I suppose.
Well, yes. Still, it is a command in a way, isn't it? Even if it's such a short voyage. You know?
I hope it will be a short voyage, Hornblower. You never know with a prize ship and prisoners. Watch that French crew. If you don't, they'll retake the ship and have you in a French jail before you know it. What English port are you heading for?
Well, sir, I suppose whatever port's nearest.
We both gazed up at the French brig as a cutter drew alongside. Struck by our fire, her fore topsail yard dangled precariously and the jib halyard had slacked way off. The sail was flapping loudly in the wind.
How many men will you want, Hornblower?
Well, the captain told me to take 4 of your men, sir.
They'd better be topmen, then. You'll have to get that jib in fast, or you will be in a bad condition.
Aye, sir.
Shall I pick 4 good men from you, for my crew?
I'd be very much obliged if you would, sir. You know them better than I do.
All right. Matthews?
Aye, sir.
Carson?
Aye, sir.
Hunter?
Aye, sir.
Smith?
Aye, sir.
You're detailed to man this brig under command of Mr. Hornblower.
Aye, sir.
Keep them away from drinking, they'll be all right. Well, here you are then, Mr. Hornblower. Watch out when you spring up those main chains. Lots of white water in between the two vessels, you'll notice. Here, Matthews, give Mr. Hornblower a hand there. On his other side.
Wait for it, sir. Get ready. Now,
jump, sir.
I hurled myself up, all arms and legs, like a leaping frog at the brig's main chains. My knees slipped off, and the rolling brig lured me thigh-deep into the boiling sea. But one of the seamen had preceded me. He grabbed at my wrists and hauled me aboard. The three other seamen followed us. A little the worse for wear, I led the way onto the deck.
Well, men, we'll reconnoiter a bit first.
Aye, aye, sir.
We'll be close in with you. Don't worry.
Take care of yourself, Hornblower.
Thank you, sir. I will. I don't see many signs of life aboard, I must say, Matthew.
Men aft, sir. A little knot of them around that hatch cover, see?
Oh, yes. Hand on my dirk, I advanced slowly aft. Suddenly, something was raised towards the sky above the heads of the crouching men. I halted and looked again. It was an up-tilted wine bottle. They'd broken open the wine stores, were cheating their captors of them, at least, in as prompt and practical a way as possible. I couldn't really say I blamed them much.
They've made the best of their time, sir. That's apparent.
One of the group, his white hair blowing in the wind, rose to meet us. His lips seemed to be shaping some pronouncement of importance, searching earnestly for the right words to use.
To the devil with the English!
Put that bottle down. Do you hear, Frenchman?
I didn't need to remember Ross's warning. If I didn't solve this situation instantly, my boarding party would be at the wine along with his French crew. And a frightening picture rose up in my mind. A disabled ship drifting about the Bay of Biscay, manned by a tipsy crew. A quick show of authority was called for.
Put it down, do you hear me? You understand English? If not, at least you can see that I'm armed. And here's my pistol. Put that down.
He's obeying you, sir. Good for you, sir.
You take these men forward, Matthews. You and two others. Lock them up somewhere below.
Aye, aye, sir.
My first command, such as it was, and my first lesson in the loneliness that command brings to a man at sea. And suddenly, amidst these plans, a sickening thought struck through me. I rushed on deck to find Hunter.
Hunter! Hunter, come here!
Yes, sir.
Hunter.
What is it, sir?
Look, it's occurred to me. Nothing's been done to see if the brig is taking in any water. You know, one of those shots we fired at her may have hulled her below the waterline.
That's so, sir. We'd better sound the well. Not a drop of water on the rod. Dry as yesterday's pannikin.
We can't keep the course you set much longer, sir. And the wind's coming up very gusty-like.
Oh, very good. Well, I'll be up, Hunter. Call all hands at once.
Aye, aye, sir.
I disguised my inner feelings as best I could, but it was soon apparent with the wind northerly, we'd have to go about.
All hands, worship!
With but four men to handle topsails and close haul the brig on the starboard deck, the task took all that was left of the night. By the time we'd brought her safely round, all hope of an easy 2 days' run had vanished. True, we were heading away from the dangerous shores of France, but we were also heading away from the friendly shores of England.
That French captain's been yelping his head off, sir. Insists he's got to talk to you. Important.
Release him, Hunter. Bring him up to me.
My men, they are hungry. Very hungry.
So are my men. I also. Moi aussi.
I have a cook.
Good. Well, perhaps we can arrange a truce then, Captain. If your men are allowed on deck, your cook, to provide food for all of us, will you agree to make no attempt to take the ship from us?
Of that we shall talk later, sir. There is another concern of more importance at this moment.
Well?
She rides a little heavily. Do you not think so?
Heavily? Well, yes, perhaps, but...
Perhaps she leaks.
Oh, no, no. No, there's no water in there. We've tested the well.
Tested the well? But, mon Dieu, you would find none in the well. Do you not know our cargo? Du riz, monsieur, du riz.
What?
We are carrying a cargo of rice.
Cargo of rice? Why, yes, I recall now, but after all...
From New Orleans. No leak would be apparent in the well. No. Rice would absorb every drop of water in the hold.
Yes, but...
One shot from your cursed frigate struck us in the hull. Oh. Did you not know?
Yes, well...
Hunter,
that shot hit her, after all.
Where, sir?
Well, I don't know yet. Must be somewhere on the port side forward, though. We'll have a look. You and Matthews put a bowline round me and lure it away. We're heeling on this tack, and I'll have a good view over the side. The swaying of the brig, the sea closed over my head. But there it was, below the waterline, a splintered, jagged hole.
Mr. Holmore, I call your notice to the deck seam forward there.
What?
It is opening.
What?
Hunter, look.
The pitch is even bulging out of it.
And just beyond, sir. See that other spot? There's something awful wrong.
Pitch coming in ridges from the deck seam.
Mon Dieu, I have just thought. The rice.
The rice cargo. Is that it?
It grows bigger.
What? Water's got well into it now, sir, so it's swelling.
Dry rice like salt will double, even treble its volume. This ship will burst wide open with this cargo. Oh, mon Dieu.
I remembered the unnatural creaks and groans below, and I cursed myself for inexperience. A black moment. And if I hadn't spoken sharply, I'd have broken down in tears. The sooner we get that sailor at hold, the better. Hurry those Frenchmen up, Hunter. Don't simply stand there staring.
Aye, aye, sir.
I said the ship was riding heavily. She's lower in the water already.
Be silent, sir. One crisis after another. I have to think.
Hurry with that sail. Do you hear me, man?
Sir. Sir, I don't like the look of it. Straight I don't. She's settling down and opening up below as well as on deck. That rice is pushing her apart in every sea.
Well, Matthews, I...
Looky there, sir. Even that batten down hatch cover's pushing upward. See?
Well, I'll jettison the cargo then, Matthews. Get some prisoners together and we'll start. Hunter!
All right, sir.
Take half your men off that sail work, open the hatches and bring up the cargo fast.
They all worked with a will, even the prisoners. And as they lifted off the hatch covers, brown forms shot out abruptly, rice bags forced upwards by the pressure of others below. Bag by bag, the rice was hauled up from the hold and cast overboard. Sometimes the bag split, spewing rice in every direction. It was fantastic. And finally, the lower bags, wetter and more swollen, jammed the hatchway.
Even the tackles won't sway them up now. Is that it, Hunter?
Afraid so, sir. Oh. But we've relieved her quite a bit, I will say, sir. And the sail's ready.
Good. Keep the rice party working to see if they can get rid of more cargo. Our lines row through the grummets of the sail.
Oh, yes, sir. And a good 5 square feet of sail is fathered.
Oh. Put your other men to that, then. Work the sail under the hull and drag it after the hull.
Aye, sir. Begging your pardon, sir, what are you doing?
Well, I'm undressing. I want to see it properly in place. And this time I'll go over without any clothes on, Hunter. Get a bowline ready for me. Call those men.
Naked and wet, I lost a lot of skin. The ship was rolling most of this time, but I managed to see the forward sail in place against the hull. A hairy mass sucked in instantly into position. The hull seemed fairly plugged, and they hauled me up.
Well, sir, they got a few more bags out of the hold while you was gone.
Good. I'm at Tom Matthews, can you? Hunter, hand me that shirt, will you?
She's riding better now. You notice, don't you, sir?
Yes, and the wind's improving. We'll lay her on our original course, Hunter. Northeast by north.
Aye, sir.
Well, Bush, another glass of port?
Thank you, Horatio, but go on, please.
Well, I was limp with lack of sleep, with cold and exhaustion and accumulated burdens. I'd started with the highest of resolves and now badly dampened. But at least I'd learned some lessons in that 24-hour span, and for the moment, all seemed well enough with ship and men. And as we plied heavily along, I even felt a a tiny glow of pride, unearned or not. I squared my shoulders and I took my stand there on the poop, straddling with my hands behind my back. I was still in command of my ship, Bush, such as she was. And despite the grinning fates and all my worries, she was heading home to England on a course I'd actually laid off myself. Yes, very young and earnest men. They are a bit sad, you know. Huh?
Yes, indeed.
Well, Bush, finished report?
Yes.
Well, mustn't keep my lady wife waiting, must we?
Horatio Hornblower, starring Michael Redgrave, is based on the novels of C.S. Forrester. Music composed and conducted by Sidney Torch. Produced by Harry Allen Towers.
Golden Age of Radio on WMKY in The Adventures of Horatio Hornblower, starring Michael Redgrave. First broadcast on radio on April 3rd, 1953. This has been the Golden Age of Radio, classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows. On the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at the same time and channel on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at WMKY.org.